So what's plan B today on The World? I'm Marco Werman. Ditching the Iran nuclear deal means U.S. sanctions are coming back.
These sanctions target Chinese companies, Russian companies, Turkish companies, European companies. So in a way, the U.S. is going after its allies and some of its adversaries.
And a woman in Tehran worries what the end of the deal means for dissent in Iran.
In the last couple of years, people seem to have more freedom to voice their ideas. But again, the government is going to say that, all right, shut up. Now we have an enemy.
Plus, on a different note, making the case for the koala.
Doesn't eat anyone, doesn't trample crops, just sits in a tree, looks beautiful.
So why is a koala in trouble? Find out today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you with us. After months of thinking he would, he did. The question now is, what's next as President Trump follows through with pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal? We know that U.S. sanctions on Iran are coming back into force, so let's start there. These sanctions will hit companies and countries that do business with Iran, and there are a lot of those. Opening up business with Iran was a key side effect of the nuclear agreement back in 2015. Take Boeing, for example. After the deal got inked, it started taking orders from Iranian airlines. Now with the sanctions back on, suddenly Boeing is looking at $20 billion worth of lost business. And that is just one company. Politico correspondent Nahal Tusi in Washington has been looking at how the Iran sanctions will be re-implemented.
Well, technically speaking, the sanctions kick back in effective immediately. That means that if you're a company that wants to do business in Iran, you're not going to be able to do it. That being said, there is what's called a wind down period. And that means that if you're a company that currently is doing business with Iran, you're going to have between 90 days and 180 days to pull your business out of Iran.
So 90 to 180 days. I mean, who gets to wait longest?
It depends on the sector. Like, for instance, if you're in the energy sector, you're probably going to get a bit more time. But it's important to note one other thing. This isn't really about American companies because due to a large number of currently existing sanctions on Iran that the U.S. has, American businesses really can't do business there. These sanctions target Chinese companies, Russian companies, Turkish companies, European companies in particular, like basically any company in a third country that does business with Iran. So in a way, the U.S. is going after its allies and some of its adversaries.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if our allies start violating sanctions intentionally or not, what is the U.S. prepared to do?
Well, this is a huge part of the unknown that we're facing right now. Because what happens is, look, if you are, say, a French company and you say, look, I really want to do business in Iran, you can try to do that and get away with it, but you're not going to be allowed to do any sort of business in U.S. dollars. That means you're going to be cut off from your access to the U.S. market. That's a huge market. Are you going to, you know, give up the U.S. market for the Iranian market, which is much less predictable and much more murky. So these are like the kind of questions that companies are going to have to answer. But along with that, you're going to have other countries, you know, these countries where these companies are located, they're asking themselves now whether they're going to allow the U.S. to do this to their companies. And there's some signs, at least in Britain, France, and Germany, that they want to perhaps look at legislation that would try to block Washington from punishing European companies. And they've kind of done this before. They've circumvented the U.S. embargo on Cuba in this way in the past. But it's a question, it's a bigger question as to whether they'll do it on Iran.
So there was a briefing at the State Department yesterday where officials tried to kind of explain what next with this deal that Trump has backed out of. What have you heard about the mood there?
So just to be clear, I wasn't at this briefing, but I read the transcript of it afterward and my jaw just kept falling lower and lower to the ground, because the State Department officials who were briefing the reporters, they really did not seem to have very solid answers on a lot of tough questions that the reporters were asking. And one of the key questions that the reporters kept asking is, hey, what's the next step? Do you guys know what you're going to do now with your allies and, you know, these other countries to so-and-so pressure Iran to do what you wanted to do. And they basically said, oh, you know what? No, we didn't talk about a plan B because we were busy trying to see what we could do to save the existing deal and to fix it. And so they actually admitted that they don't know what's next. They don't know if they're going to be able to bring the Europeans on board in a global coalition to pressure Iran, which is what they want. They don't know if Iran's going to bother to come back to the table, which, you know, why would it? It was really kind of astonishing. And it was very eye-opening to read what seemed to be a quite an unprepared administration for the decision that the president made yesterday.
And, you know, outside of that briefing, I mean, a lot of people have pointed it out, but it does look like there is no plan B, as those officials kind of alluded to. Is that how it looks to you, speaking with other people outside the State Department?
Look, what we know, and, you know, John Bolton, the president's national security advisor, told reporters this yesterday that they are going to immediately engage in talks with their European partners, including apparently this morning, about things they can do to move forward, next steps they can take. Because, you know, in all fairness, Europe is concerned about many of Iran's activities that are not on the nuclear front. They're concerned about Iran's involvement in the conflict in Syria, for instance, or its sponsorship of terrorism. So what we've been told is essentially that the administration is going to continue to talk to these other countries. But that, frankly, doesn't really say much. I mean, if they weren't talking, I guess we'd be a little more worried. But the fact that they're just going to keep talking, that there's not even a time frame. I mean, one of the questions people were asking yesterday at the State Department briefing is, well, how long are you going to talk before you declare that this is working or it's not working? And they couldn't put a time frame on it.
Politico correspondent Nahal Tusi speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much, Nahal.
Thank you for having me.
Clearly, the return of U.S. sanctions on Iran will have a big impact on the Iranian economy and on politics there. And that's got a lot of people worried in the country. We've spoken before with Roya, a translator who lives in Tehran. She asks that we use only her first name. Today, we reached out to her again.
In the last couple of years, people seem to have more freedom to voice their ideas. But again, the government is going to say that, all right, shut up. Now we have an enemy. And you have to be united. You have to support your government because we're going to fight the enemy.
I mean,
as they always did.
Right. I mean, yes. The clerics and religious leaders were never really in favor of the deal themselves. How many people in Iran have followed their lead, were disappointed with the deal in the first place, and are now happy again that there is no agreement with America?
Well, I don't know how many, but at the time of the sanctions, the luxury cars were imported to Iran while we could not get the medicine. So how could these sanctions help the Iranian people? And it's going to happen this time. Your president says that he stands with the Iranian people. I cannot find the logic behind it, how he's going to stand with us. He should know that this regime, I mean, the Iranian regime is an ideological regime and is willing to sacrifice its people for their causes. So they're not going to back up because of their people. So all the suffering will be ours. I mean, the ordinary people's.
When President Trump says, you know, we stand with the Iranian people, don't you think that maybe he's saying because the Iranian regime is taking care of this money and getting rich while the sanctions are happening, they don't care about the people, so therefore Trump does care about the people. That's the logic, I think.
He might want to mean this, but the Iranian regime has been doing this for 40 years, and the U.S. government has been more or less approaching this issue in the same way, apart from the time of Mr. Obama. So it did not solve the problem. You have to find a new way.
Does President Trump have any support in Iran, any supporters?
Well, no. Honestly, no.
None that you know of.
You know, some people are fed up. They just say that, okay, he is going to end our lives in a way with a war or, I don't know, in a way that we don't feel more misery. But this is not good positive support. And, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, how many people, you know, heard this announcement and thought war is now inevitable?
I can tell you everybody I know of, and I talked to them today, were saying that war can be an option. Because the U.S. and Israel are very hostile towards Iran, and of course, some other countries in the Middle East. If the Europeans are not able to keep the deal with Iran and to keep Iran committed to the deal, then the whole world, again, will be on one side and Iran will be on another side. And I think that the United States will benefit in a war by selling weapons to the countries in the region. I don't know why your people should want to get involved in a war and why the poor people of Iran should be victims of another war.
Well, polling suggests that over 60% of Americans did not want Trump to pull out of this deal. But those are polls, and we see a lot of numbers in polls. Yeah, I want to ask you about I want to ask you about this.
But the decision is made by your president, not the polls, huh?
That's true. I'm looking at this photo on Twitter of Iranian lawmakers setting fire to a paper U.S. flag in parliament there, shouting death to America. This happened, I think, just shortly after.
It happened this morning. Happened this morning. And so you see that they haven't changed a bit. They are the same silly people they have been through all these 40 years.
It's kind of a classic trope of the Islamic Revolution. Today, how does that thing go over with most of the public?
The public doesn't approve of that.
They don't.
No, they don't.
Why not?
Your president has made a wrong choice, but insulting a country's flag is something that we don't approve of. A lot of people, even the people who don't approve of Mr. Trump and who don't, even they are kind of supporter of the regime, they don't approve of setting fire on a country's flag, another country's flag. I know the American people get hurt when they see such a scene on their TVs. So I'm really sorry when I see they feel disrespected.
My sense from being in Iran a couple of years ago for just a few days is that symbols of American culture are still very powerful. Fast food or the movies, Michael Jackson, I know, is still very popular.
Yeah.
What does America mean today to Iran, the day after this announcement?
America is still a great country to the Iranians. I'm talking about the Iranian people. People still love America. You see that we have a lot of coke like the Americans do. The Europeans always tell us that, oh, come on, you eat like the Americans. You eat hamburgers and you drink a lot of coke like the Americans do. And we love your movies and we love your music. And still, I think most of the Iranian, ordinary Iranian, would like to visit the United States, go to Vegas, go to LA. They like everything about the United States. When you go to buy something and when you see that it's written on it, it's written made in the U.S., they say, oh, that's a good one. Let's buy that.
Yeah.
We have no hostility towards the United States. But you hear, of course, you hear the voice of the regimes.
Roya, it's always good to speak with you. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Thank you.
Before we take a break, I want you to hear a moment from today's confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill for Gina Haspel. She's President Trump's choice to be the next director of Central Intelligence. Haspel's been getting grilled about the CIA's secret detention and interrogation program in the years after 9/11. She was involved with that program's use of secret prisons and torture of terror suspects. Haspel now promises that under her direction, the CIA would not restart such a program.
Having served in that tumultuous time, I can offer you my personal commitment, clearly and without reservation, that under my leadership, on my watch, CIA will not restart a detention and interrogation program.
A lot of skeptical senators on that one. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from someone who takes Haspel at her word, former director of Central Intelligence, General Michael Hayden. He knows Haspel and agrees she would never reintroduce torture into the CIA's playbook.
Let me tell you why she will never do it. Because we did this on behalf of the American people. We thought it was a reflection of what the nation wanted us to do at that time. We thought the nation or the administration or the political class had our back. They did not. As administrations changed, agency officers were hung out to dry, put through legal processes. No serious CIA director would direct his or her officers to go out and do this again.
More of my conversation with General Michael Hayden tomorrow here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. When Basir Qazi went to help out in the refugee camps in Bangladesh, he had a sense of what he was getting into. Qazi is a doctor at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. He knew about the 700,000 Rohingya refugees who'd fled a brutal military crackdown in Myanmar for the relative safety of Bangladesh. And he knew that resources at the refugee camps were really scarce. But it wasn't until Dr. Qazi actually arrived that he understood the scope of what he was about to do. Qazi told me about his trip this March to Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, as a volunteer with the Deccan Alumni Association of North America.
We're trying to send two or three doctors a week. I was able to go in the first week of March. Along with me was my friend, Dr. Habib Sheikh, who's an oncologist here locally, and Dr. Sayed Zafar from Florida, who brought his son. He's a first-year medical student. The trips are 1 week in duration each. They include staffing a medical clinic. We're blessed to have some good partners locally there in Bangladesh called Hope Foundation. And we are helping staff one of the clinics of Hope Foundation. We also helped the humanitarian aspect with food distribution. And one big project that we were involved with was the Clean Drinking Water Project.
Tell us about the conditions in the refugee camps in Cox's Bazar. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of Rohingya there. What are they dealing with?
Cox's Bazar is the main city port for aid workers to kind of stay. It's a 90-minute drive to the refugee camps. And when you travel from the city, you see the roads kind of dissipate and you kind of get on these dirt roads and the conditions just become pretty bleak. The most astonishing thing is there's such a great amount of people in a small concentrated area. You go to these areas within the camp and you have a whole family living in this small room, 10 by 10, 12 by 12. The roofing is temporary. You can't even stand in there. There's no electricity. There's no running water. There's no proper sanitation. You're asking for infectious disease to really, especially when the monsoon comes, to be rampant in these areas. The need is very dire. The World Food Program has called it the largest camp in the world, if you just take it by sheer numbers.
From a medical standpoint, what occupied most of your time? Was it injuries the refugees sustained during the violence in Myanmar or fleeing it, or was it just the poor conditions in the camps themselves?
I think things have evolved with time. Obviously, the summer of 2017 is when people saw a lot of the trauma, the post-traumatic stress disorder, the sheer fear of death. I went there a little bit later in March, and what I saw was kind of the aftermath where people are trying to get some normalcy within their life. As far as diseases that we saw, a whole host of malnutrition in various forms with anemia, vitamin deficiencies. We also saw infectious diseases, including mumps, chickenpox, and other things. One particular case that I saw was a female who came in with shoulder pain. And as I got more comfortable within the camps, I was able to get a more detailed history through our translators. And this lady was about 70 years old, and no one really figured out what her shoulder pain was from, but after getting a detailed history, we found out that when she was leaving Myanmar, one of the soldiers took his rifle and actually hit her with the rifle. And that's the reason, it's the trauma from the actual sheer injury that she sustained. So we were able to transfer her to get better orthopedic care to a field hospital. I think once a day or two within the camps, we started getting more detailed history, we could realize what these individuals have gone through.
How many patients did you see during your time there?
So an average day at the clinic would normally start around 9 o'clock, about 90-minute drive into the campsite. And we were in makeshift tents, and we would see about 45 to 50 patients. We had access to some basic labs, like a urinalysis and blood sugar. We did have a pharmacy, but that's about it. We were communicating well with the different teams. We had a list of common diagnoses we were going to see, so that really helped out.
Dr. Qazi, you mentioned the translator you had with you. What were the kinds of stories you heard from patients?
The mass exodus in August, that was the key, because most of these patients, they walked all the way across from Myanmar to Bangladesh, and the horror stories you heard in between. I mean, they would tear up, and I would try to get a better history through the translator, but at the same time, I was trying to be cognizant of their feelings as well and not try to bring back bad memories. But sometimes in the line of trying to get an adequate diagnosis, you need to kind of do that. And I knew, especially when seeing female patients that are pregnant, which we saw plenty of, the fear was, were they raped? They're coming to us for medical help. We didn't want to reintroduce the horror that they had faced. post-traumatic stress disorder is a big diagnosis there. And we're trying to address those issues in a more systematic way by including psychiatric care. Anxiety, depression, these are all pretty rampant within the refugee camps, as one would expect.
Do you think the camps are ready for what's about to happen?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the monsoon season is kind of one of the largest potential catastrophes. The government is trying. I mean, the Bangladeshi government, I really admire the work they're trying to do. The UN is there, the WHO, many, many international agencies are there. They're trying to relocate 100,000 refugees. This was already being done while I was there, to safer levels, because the expectations, unfortunately, with the monsoon season approaching, is catastrophe, loss of life, and obviously when the waters come, increased risk of infectious diseases, salmonella, shigella, also the risk of malaria, and so on and so forth.
If there's one thing, one image, one snapshot from your trip that you want people to know about what's happening with the Rohingya and in these camps in Bangladesh, what would it be?
For me personally, the most catastrophic experience was, you know, seeing these little kids, 9 years old, 6 years old, 5 years old, walking into the clinic, no shoes, poor hygiene, poor dental hygiene. I wouldn't say they're completely malnourished, but you know they're undernourished at least. And just seeing that picture day in and day out, that was the most difficult thing, especially having young kids. And you just figure that could have been my kid right there. I mean, that was the most difficult part of my trip. The children of Rohingya are going to be a lost generation if we don't act in a longer-term goal mindset. What I mean by that is setting goals for their nutrition, for their education, and setting goals for their well-being.
Basir Kazi is a doctor at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. He recently traveled to Bangladesh to help treat Rohingya refugees. We've got a bit of time before we bring you the latest headlines, so let me give you a preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow on the show. It's about an island paradise you've probably never heard of. It's called Socotra, and it's in the Indian Ocean between Yemen and Somalia. And one of its selling points is an amazing piece of flora called the Dragon's Blood Tree. Journalist Lucy Towers had to check it out.
I can only describe it as like an umbrella. You have these tightly packed in branches and a dome of green on top, and they're thousands of years old. But the weirdest thing about them, or what makes them maybe so special and gives them the name Dragon's Blood, is that the sap is crimson. And it's been used for hundreds of years by those living on the island for medicine, paint, makeup, varnish, and you see these dotted around the island, and with every turn of the road, you see these trees looming up.
More on the island of Socotra, its beauty and its troubles, tomorrow here on the show. I'm Marco Werman. People who get deported back to Mexico are supposed to get help from the government there. But when this man tried to follow up...
They were so disorganized, they didn't know where to send me. I mean, if they were like, well, I don't know what they sent you here. I have nothing to do with you. Like, I can't help you with nothing right now.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Early last year, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto welcomed 135 people deported from the United States at the airport in Mexico City. He was promoting a government program called Somos Mexicanos, We Are Mexican. It's intended to help deported Mexicans get back on their feet in Mexico. But the funding comes from local budgets, so the help that's available can be uneven. That's what Omar Blas Olvera found when he was deported to Mexico last July. He was working as a contractor in Michigan when he was detained by ICE and deported for the third time. Initially, his wife and two children stayed behind. Omar set out to build a new life in San Miguel de Allende, his hometown in Mexico, so they could join him. When I spoke with Omar today, I asked him what was going through his mind on that flight back to Mexico last July.
Oh, I was thinking that was really it for me in the States. I mean, when the ICE agent had me in custody, he was telling me, like, honestly, you know, this is your third time, but looking at your record, since that you have not been doing anything terrible. And he told me that he was going to recommend not to give me any jail time. At the end, he was like, this will be your last chance if you ever come back again. then you're for sure going to go to jail, and you will go to a federal prison. It's not just going to jail. So from there, I was like, that's really it. I mean, I'm not going to risk going to jail and not really see my family at all. And I couldn't risk that. So I just decided to stay in Mexico. I talked to my wife, and then she was okay to come with me and then with the kids and then to move down here. I mean, I didn't see him from July till October 18.
I suspect they were also on your mind as you were flying back to Mexico because they remained in Michigan at the time.
They were on my mind the moment the ICE picked me up. I mean, I knew that they were going to pick me up. We were hearing stories all over our town about immigration just like popping up, driving in regular cars, undercover cars, showing up to people's work or people's houses. Like if you live in an apartment complex, they will just go around the apartment complex every morning to see who lives there, who's not there. Then after 2 weeks, they will just know who to stop and who to get. When I seen a Explorer behind me, and I didn't recognize that car being around the trailer park where I was staying, I knew right away. I mean, something inside of me just told me. So I just called my wife and I told her, like, I'm about to be arrested. And my wife actually said, like, they were on a stop sign or something. I was like, no, I'm going to be arrested by ICE. Right at that moment, my family was on my mind because I didn't know where I was going to see them again. I didn't know what was going to happen with me. I mean, I started crying. You know, I'm not afraid to say that I was crying. They gave me a chance to make a call, and I was talking to my son and my daughter, and, you know, I just break down, and they were crying on the other side of the phone. My son didn't even know what was going on. My daughter, unfortunately, knew because in 2010, I had one deportation also, and she kind of remembers that because I didn't see him for about 8 months.
Yeah, that's very emotional. Mexico has a kind of reintegration or welcoming program called Somos Mexicanos, and it's supposed to kick in when you reach the airport in Mexico. What happened when you arrived?
Did that kick in? I mean, when you arrive, they basically hand you this folder with a packet inside it, and on that packet, it has provisional ID. It's a piece of paper with a picture that they take of you from immigration. They give you that, and they give you a paper saying that they have a plan to help deported people where you can start your own business, where they can get you a job, when they could get you housing. You know, all of this great stuff that is on this booklets. I mean, you're reading the papers, and you're like, oh, my God, you know, thank God they're helping people. And they're telling you, like, okay, you can go to this address, you can call this phone number. You feel a little bit of hope after everything that went wrong, you know. So I got to San Miguel. You know, I started calling those places.
Right.
I went to one in Guanajuato, and when I show up there, they were like, they send you to the wrong place. This is not really for what they send you to. Right here, we can help you apply for a visa to go to work in Canada, and that will be for like a farmer's visa or to work in a farm or something like that. And I was like, well, that's not what I'm looking for, but I'm surprised that you guys are offering visas but not offering help for people that are being deported.
Sounds like the Somos Mexicanos program is a little disorganized. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong. I mean, they were so disorganized, they didn't know where to send me. I mean, from that office that I'm telling you about right now, they sent me back to San Miguel. From San Miguel, they told me to go to the passport office. From there, they also told me, like, well, I don't know why they sent you here. You know, I can do nothing for you here. So they helped me and call a place in Celaya. Now, the place in Celaya, the person who answered was really nice. She gave me another address and another number. So I called that one place that she gave me, and then they were like, nope, you got to go back to San Miguel. You got to go back to to the office in San Miguel where they give you the passports.
So you've been back in Mexico now for almost a year. Do you have any form of official ID or identification yet?
At the end, I did. But it took me, let's say, from July when I arrived, it took me to the end of August. I was getting just my ID. And then from there, I was able to get, like, my driver's license. I was able to get my CURP. The CURP is almost like your social security number. All of the paperwork that they give you at the airport, it doesn't help you to get none of that. It's unbelievable.
So when you were living in Michigan, you worked for a tiling company. Were you hoping to kind of continue the same work in Mexico? And were you looking to start a business?
I did. And that was because they had a program where you can start your own business. So I got all the paperwork together. I took it back to them. They were like, well, you know what? The fund is almost running out, and then we'll call you to tell you if you got in or not. This was almost a year. It's unbelievable.
So I gather you're currently working at a bar and got a promotion recently. Have you kind of given up on the Mexican government for help?
Yeah, I mean, I've been working really hard, and I mean, like, really hard to get where I am right now. Right now, I'm the COO of the restaurant. You know, I went from a busser to being like a manager for construction when they were doing remodeling. Then from there, the boss took me to quality manager. And then from there, he kind of restructured the whole thing in the restaurant, like who was doing what. So I ended up being the COO.
Right. So Omar, I'm just curious to know, I mean, what is next for your family?
Probably stay in San Miguel and just have our life here. I would prefer that 100 times than trying to go back or trying to fight with lawyers and all of that. I could spend years and years putting petitions in, putting a waiver in, and at the end, they might just turn me down. And I'd just rather be here, keep working, be with my family, and be happy.
Right.
You know?
I know San Miguel de Allende is your hometown, but it's changed a lot. And there are a lot of Americans there now for retirement, as many as 15% of the city's population. What does it feel like to be back in kind of an American colony of sorts after you've been deported from America?
It feels good. You kind of connect with people a little more, you know, even here in the restaurant, when you get to talk to people like, oh, where were you staying in the States? And you tell them Michigan, and they're like, oh, well, my cousin is from Michigan. You can talk to people really easily. I mean, people in San Miguel are really nice, and the people that are coming to live in San Miguel from the States are really nice, too. So, you know, it kind of feels a little bit warming to know that somehow you can still have a part of the U.S.
Omar Blas Olvera was deported from the U.S. last year. He now lives in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. The Trump administration has also moved in recent months to end TPS, temporary protected status, for hundreds of thousands of immigrants. And that could compound the challenges facing labor unions here in the U.S. Organized labor has lost millions of members since the 1980s. Now the loss of TPS status could mean losing thousands more. Amy Bracken looked into why.
On a chilly afternoon at Harvard University, people are rallying in support of prison education. Speakers include a formerly incarcerated man, student activists, and union reps like Doris Reina Landaverde.
Hi, everybody. My name is Doris.
Reina Landaverde is a custodian at Harvard and a member of the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU Local 32BJ. She's here to show her union's solidarity with other movements. But soon, after 12 years of cleaning offices and classrooms at Harvard, she will be out of her job and out of the union. In 2001, Reina Landaverde got temporary protected status, or TPS. It let her stay in the U.S. legally after earthquakes struck her native El Salvador. But the Trump administration is letting that protection expire next year, saying the country has recovered from the earthquakes and it's time for Salvadorans to return home, despite having built lives in the U.S. Now, Reina Landaverde is facing possible unemployment and deportation to El Salvador, a foreign land for her children and husband. And the future of the union?
Oh, they will lose a lot of members.
It's not clear how many, but Reina Landaverde thinks hundreds of her union's 18,000 members in New England have TPS, and many work at Harvard. She says they'll all drop out of the union because they'll lose their jobs. It's a similar story for Unite Here Local 26, the Union of Hotel and Restaurant Workers. Edward Childs is a cook at a Harvard dining hall and a Unite Here union leader, and he estimates that hundreds of his union's members also have TPS.
If you lose 1,000 workers and you only have 10,000 workers, you've lost a lot of your membership. The union will be in total disarray.
It's one reason unions are lobbying hard to protect the status of immigrant members. It's a relatively new fight for unions, says Robert Foran, a labor historian at the University of Massachusetts Lowell.
I mean, the labor movement in America doesn't have a glorious history of standing at the barricades for civil and political rights for people that look slightly different than the heads of most of the really big labor unions. And, I mean, that's changing.
One change was at the end of the 20th century when the AFL-CIO, the Union Federation, went from supporting sanctions on employers who hired undocumented workers to opposing them. In recent years, Ferrant says, the unions that have grown are largely sectors with a lot of immigrant workers. He says it's made labor and immigrant issues more entwined.
I don't think in 2018 you can say you're for workers' rights if you're not also saying you're for immigrant rights. You cannot separate the two.
Foran adds that Latin American immigrants often play particularly important union roles because of their language skills and their cultures.
Well, workers coming from South American, Central American countries where a lot of union organizing really revolves around family and sort of house-to-house organizing and having lots of house meetings and barbecues and cookouts. And when they're doing that organizing, that's just part of it. There's a flavor to it other than just sort of starkly walking up to somebody on the job and saying, are you for or against the union? Will you sign this card?
As for Reina Landaverde, she says it took some time for her to realize her importance in the union.
First, I think the union not do nothing, because sometimes I think the union is the organization. But one thing I learned is, like, the union, we are the people, like workers, all workers together, we are the union.
She's rallied coworkers to speak out against an abusive supervisor who was then fired. She helped organize custodians to demonstrate for a better contract and to support Harvard dining hall workers on a strike that grabbed headlines.
From today, we are on strike.
For the first time in 30 years, Harvard University employees are striking.
This is the first time in the union's history that workers walked off the job during the strike.
People still protesting this noon, holding signs like support the strike. They say they will be out here picketing until their demands are met.
Among the leaders of that strike were immigrants like Martha Bonilla, an organizer with Unite Here from El Salvador. She worked 12-hour days at Harvard cafeterias. She says it was tough to keep the strike going, and it touched close to home since her husband was a coworker.
And he come out one day and say, I'm sorry, but I need to go back to work. And I said, no, you're not going back to work. And then he said, yeah, we're going to need the money to pay the mortgage. And I said, no, everybody's going to stay.
She managed to convince him and others.
We went the second week, and a lot of people would say, I had to go back to work. I can't be here. And then I would tell them, no, we had to stay here. And sometimes we used to fight each other, like screaming at each other. Okay, what are you talking about? We had to stay here. We had to fight together.
And after 3 weeks on strike, the union declared victory. Now, Bonilla and Reina Landaverde are on their next big fight to stay in the union and the United States. For The World, Amy Bracken, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I like riddles. You like riddles? Anyway, here's a quick riddle before the break.
Doesn't eat anyone, doesn't trample the crops, just sits in a tree, looks beautiful.
What animal are we talking about?
Makes $3 billion worth of tourism. Everyone who wants to touch them, including Mr. Putin, Mr. Obama, Mr., you know, Gorbachev.
The accent is a useful clue.
Everyone's got a koala in their hands. And we don't say, well, this is important to us.
Koalas, Australia's national icon after the kangaroo, and they are important to Australians. The problem is the koala isn't doing so well right now. There are only about 40,000 of them left in the wild.
And in one section of Australia where I live, there were 30,000 and now there's less than 1,000. So the declines are just massive. If you can't save a koala, you can't save anything.
By the way, that's Deborah Tabart, CEO of the Australian Koala Foundation. In Australia, they call her the Koala Woman. She tells my colleagues at the BBC that the dangers to koalas go way back to when koalas were seen as trophies.
8 million koalas' skins came to London and New York in the 1900s. It's just sickening.
This week, the Australian state of New South Wales announced its most ambitious scheme yet to save the country's koalas. $34 million that will be used to establish forest reserves for a koala habitat and a hospital to care for sick and injured marsupials. The money will also go towards protective measures like fences along the roads to keep koalas from becoming roadkill. Supporters say it's a good first step, but Deborah Tabart says it's not enough.
I can tell you our country is in ecological collapse. We are just doing wanton destruction. And there is not one mention in this press release about decent laws. This is about, we'll do this, we'll make a bigger hospital. But that's like building bigger asthma hospitals and not keeping the air clean.
For Tabart and the Koala Foundation, the real issues are deforestation and destroyed habitats. And fixing those goes well beyond $34 million. A few days ago, Egyptian plainclothes security officers arrived at the home of Shadi Abu Zaid outside of Cairo. They arrested him, seized his computer and phone, and drove away. Shadi Abu Zaid is a satirist. He produces online satirical videos, which often go viral on social media. His work frequently pokes fun at the Egyptian government and how ridiculously widespread censorship is in Egypt. but we weren't sure if it was his satire that got Abu Zaid arrested, so we decided to ask Jonathan Geyer. He's a journalist who lived in Cairo for 5 years. He knows the Egyptian satire scene inside and out and blogs about it at Cartoon. He's currently a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard, so we were able to invite him in over to our studios here in Boston.
Thank you, Marco.
Tell us about Shadi Abu Zaid. Who is he and what is his brand of satire?
Abu Zaid is part of a really loose network of satirists, web bloggers, video comedians, meme makers in Egypt and in the region. And these are viral video guys, really off-color, offbeat, not overtly political, but he has often strayed towards those red lines that seem to get on people's nerves.
And so how popular is he in Egypt and in the region? Are people like going on YouTube and saying, I'm going to watch some Shadi Abu Zaid today?
Shadi Abu Zaid is mostly known in Egypt, but he made waves in 2016 when he was blowing up balloons and handing them to police in Tahrir Square, except they weren't balloons at all. They were condoms. And this caused quite an uproar.
Yes. So what was the consequence of doing that?
That was really just a kind of outrage and slap on the wrist situation. But he was writing and serving as a correspondent for a popular puppet show. We talked about it before, Marco.
Right.
Abla Fahita, which this salacious female auntie of a puppet who's been accused of being a Muslim Brotherhood member, who's been accused of all sorts of obscenities, goes to show you that there's a lot of sensitivity around any kind of satire or anything approximating dissent in Egypt today.
So Shadi's now been arrested. Is there any evidence that his arrest was because of his satire?
Not at all, Marco. It seems that Shadi's arrest, which happened on Sunday morning, is more likely part of tens of thousands of political prisoners who've been detained in Egypt. Most of them forcibly disappeared. There are about 1,300 who were forcibly disappeared by Egyptian authorities in 2017.
So when you say disappeared, what does that mean? Detained?
Largely detained without any due process, inability to see a lawyer, unknown whereabouts, no visits from family. In fact, this is a consistent feature of the Egyptian state right now. About 3 people are being forcibly disappeared a day, according to local watchdogs.
That's extraordinary. So, I mean, why are they being arrested, all these hundreds of people?
Experts have been telling me that this is part of a bigger move to shrink public space, public discourse. In Egypt, the former general Abdel Fattah el-Sisi was reelected to a second presidential term just last month. Having said that, he seems to be very paranoid if you're reading between the lines, and the Egyptian intelligence services have been buying up TV networks, media outlets, and seeming to stomp out dissent wherever it stands.
Where is Shadi Abu Zaid now?
Shadi Abu Zaid was last seen in a national security prosecutor's office in New Cairo. Unclear what he's been charged with. He's going to be detained for 15 days under this pre-trial detention, which is being used across the board. Thousands of people are being held really unjustly using pretrial detention. So the main difference between Shadi Abu Zaid and the rest of them is we know his name.
I just have a really hard time believing that his satire had no role in his arrest.
I know, Marco. And this is one of these murky red lines that we find in Egypt, where there is an outrageous amount of satire online. There's a lot of jokers, meme makers, and cartoonists everywhere you look. And we never know what are the exact reasons that people get caught up in the authorities' dragnet. And I think this case goes to show, yes, satire does have an important, powerful role. It's also ambiguous, and we don't know where it fits into the bigger spectrum.
What would you say links Abu Zaid to other people who are arrested? Is there any kind of thread there?
The main thread with Abu Zaid and others is they're young people. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time. He, like some other media actors who have a kind of following on social media, are perhaps seen as threatening by authorities. And of course, BuzzFeed has reported that Egyptian security forces closely monitor social media using advanced technology from the West.
So as you say, it sounds like one of the things that distinguishes Abu Zaid and his arrest is that we're talking about him. He is known. But what about other people who kind of occupy that same general space? I'm thinking of the 25 journalists who just this year have been arrested, joining many other journalists in prison. So they've been charged with fake news, distributing fake news. Is this a new charge?
We know it in the Trump era as a kind of buzzword. But in fact, this is a threat, a red line that often faces journalists who are just doing their job. So, of course, these are preposterous charges. But what I found really interesting is the Committee to Protect Journalists, of course, a group that looks at press freedom across the world, was particularly concerned with Abu Zaid's case because he does a lot of these man-on-the-street interviews,
yeah,
kind of like what you might see on The Daily Show, where they go out and talk to Egyptians on the street. And the Committee to Protect Journalists said, hey, he's a satirist, but his work looks a lot like what we do as journalists. And if he's under threat, then our whole profession, in fact, faces perils.
So, Jonathan, pull back. What does this all tell us? These arrests of journalists, of citizens, of Shadi Abu Zaid, a satirist. What does this all tell us about where Egypt is at right now?
There's two things I want to say, Marco. The first is the human rights situation is dire. And although the U.S. administration is working behind the scenes, I think a lot more can be done to draw attention to what seems to be tens of thousands of forcibly disappeared people, many of whom we don't know their name. But the second point, and I think this always bears repeating, is that all of these satirists still have a sense of humor. They're still working in spite of these perils. And I'm sure people will be posting new videos, cartoons, and memes about Shadi in the days to come.
Jonathan Geyer is currently a fellow at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. His blog about Arabic comics and caricature is called Cartoon. Jonathan, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Jonathan has written an item for us about Shadi Abu Zaid's arrest. You can find it at PRI.org. Here's some music I've been meaning to share with you for months. This is Havana Meets Kingston, a collection of artists from two places that have a lot in common, including a high density of seriously talented musicians and water. This song is Row Fisherman Row. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We're back with you tomorrow.
Why must there be so much war upon the land? This is one thing I, man, just can't understand. Fools fight for power, they don't know.
PRI, Public Radio International.